Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the bombing of Syria by the US and five Gulf Arab countries and look into why aircraft and 40 cruise missiles targeted the Khorasan group, which the Obama administration believes was on the verge of executing attacks against the US and Europe. An expert on the various jihadist groups and their offshoots, Nicholas Harris, a Middle East researcher at the Center for a New American Security, joins us to discuss the internal political factionalism within the jihadist movement and the extent to which the Khorasan group is al-Qaeda's elite special forces unit organized to target the far enemy using foreign fighters who have flocked to Syria from the US, the UK and Europe, who they train to return to their countries of origins with sophisticated explosive devices. Then we'll explore the reasons for Turkey's reluctance to join the anti-Islamic State coalition and whether they will act soon, as well as assess the durability of the Assad regime that is all but irrelevant as foreign air forces bomb its territory to defeat an enemy that the Assads have been unable or unwilling to confront. An expert on Turkey and Syria, Henri Baki, a professor of international relations at Lehigh University who served on the United States State Department's policy planning staff, joins us to discuss the impact of the U.S. and its Arab allies extending the war against the Islamic State in Iraq into Syria. Then finally, we will look into Tuesday's UN Summit on Climate Change with Robert Stavins, a professor and the director of the Environmental Economics Program at the Harvard Kennedy School and lead author of three climate reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. We will discuss his recent article at the New York Times, Climate Realities, and the gulf between a looming and perhaps irreversible crisis the planet faces and the faltering efforts of political leaders to begin to address climate change. And joining us now is Nicholas Harris, who's a Middle East researcher at the Center for a New American Security. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Lebanon and Syria and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in many publications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Harris.
Thank you for having me today.
And the strikes that took place on Monday night in Syria involving U.S. cruise missiles and aircraft, along with aircraft from five Arab countries in the neighborhood. Apparently, I think all of the cruise missiles, which came across the Assad part of Syria, for the want of a better description, obviously from the Mediterranean, they seem to be all targeted against this new group called Khorasan. And my understanding, first of all, Khorasan is, of course, the area that the jihadists refer to, the area largely from Afghanistan and Pakistan, the border area there. And what's your understanding about this group? And now they've been designated as even being more scary than the Islamic State.
As best as we are able to discern from reporting on the ground and from sources and Middle Eastern sources, the Khorasan group is a special forces cadre for Al Qaeda. It's external attacks arm, composed of a mix of different fighters of different backgrounds, all of whom are veteran jihadists. Some of these fighters are from Afghanistan and Pakistan. Some are from the core Middle Eastern countries. Others are from North Africa. And there are also reports that there are some fighters from Western, particularly European, ethnicities that are part of the Khorasan group. The Khorasan group is, in a way, it's al-Qaeda's response to the assertion that ISIS has now taken up the banner of the global jihadist movement. And it, as an organization, it is reported to have particular expertise in explosives making, targeted assassination, and for conducting attacks in very highly secure areas. It had been moving into Syria and liaisoning with Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. And that the attacks that occurred last night occurred in western Aleppo governorate, away from ISIS-controlled areas, and in areas that were controlled by Jabhat al-Nusra and also by some other smaller local armed opposition groups that had been cooperating with Jabhat al-Nusra against the Assad regime.
So what's the sense then of this group? You've just implied, Nicholas Harris, that maybe they were, Al-Qaeda was a little peeved at the idea that they were being marginalized in the press and also being marginalized by Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the self-appointed caliph, who basically says, I'm taking over. So are they trying to make themselves more relevant? Is that what's going on here?
I agree with that assertion, that the Khorasan group is, the fact that it had been tracked into Syria, and Syria, you know, is a natural stage and point for attacks against U.S. allies in the region, Arab allies, whether it's Jordan, Saudi Arabia, potentially attacks in Lebanon against Hezbollah, potentially attacks in Turkey, depending on how the Turkish government decides to intervene. But also, it's a convenient place to network with Europeans and Americans and other Westerners who went to Syria for jihad. And Jabhat al-Nusra had been one of the major organizations in the Syrian conflict that had received foreign fighters. So the presence of the Khorasan group in Jabhat al-Nusra-controlled regions of Syria would also have allowed them a way to network potentially with foreign fighters that had been vetted by Jabhat al-Nusra, that Jabhat al-Nusra that could trust, that they believed weren't agents of various spy organizations, and would have been another way for Al-Qaeda to project its force, which has been a major criticism of it over the last year.
So did they go to Syria? Because the leader of this group, Khorasan, Muhsin al-Fadli, he's a short, slight Kuwaiti, 33 years old. The other leader is a Saudi national, al-Rahman Muhammad al-Juni. And they apparently, at least Fadli, arrived in Syria in April of 2013 and began working with Jabhat al-Nusra. But was that their aim, was to go there? I mean, what was their aim? To go there to make themselves more relevant, or to go there and to tap into all of these Western fighters that are showing up to do jihad? How much do we know? Because that's what the U.S. government's implying here, that they say, well, we had to strike these people because they're about to strike us, because they were really trying to recruit all these Westerners and send them to the far enemy, as Al-Qaeda called the United States.
Well, it's interesting because from the Al-Qaeda perspective, the initial project was to have two distinct branches of Al-Qaeda operating in the two countries, one in Iraq, which was to be headed by Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the other in Syria, which was to be headed by Jabhat al-Nusra's leader, Muhammad al-Julani. The presence of Muhsin al-Fadli and Muhammad al-Rahman al-Juni were originally part of that initial push to establish the Al-Qaeda presence in the Syrian conflict, both as a base to perform attacks widely in the region, but also to fight the Assad regime, which was viewed as an apostate near enemy that had supported that at the end of the Iraq war had cooperated with the United States rendition efforts when they had captured jihadists and brought them. Syria was one of the countries towards the end of the Iraq war that had taken those jihadist captives that had been rendered. And also as a means to recruit foreign fighters that had come. So from the Al-Qaeda perspective, Muhammad Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was the one that had broken away with the plan and had decided to create his state and had decided to break away from Al-Qaeda core. The re-emphasis upon taking back the narrative may be heavily influenced by recent events where ISIS has gained a lot of momentum and a lot of traction with the global jihadist community because of its willingness to go out and do and to go out and create the caliphate. And this new re-emphasis upon finding targets to attack and to try to retake the initiative and the narrative back to Al-Qaeda and its affiliates may be a product of recent events, but the presence of these men on the ground in Syria was part of a longer-term strategy that Al-Qaeda had been trying to implement prior to the leadership dispute that occurred between Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, Ayman al-Zawahiri, and Jabhat al-Nusra's Abu Muhammad al-Julani.
Again, I'm speaking with Nicholas Harris, who's a Middle East researcher at the Center for a New American Security. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in many publications. Now, our source, apparently, and I'm not sure about this, on the idea that this new group, Khorasan, is dedicating its efforts to external operations. In other words, either sending in European-born jihadis back to Europe or back to the United States. I don't know how many Americans are involved in this. The figures vary. But there are, Australia has 130, apparently. The U.S. maybe have more. The British have 500. The Dutch have a lot more. So there's quite a number of these people. But my understanding is that the leader of this new group, one of his bodyguards named Abu Rama, was captured and arrested by Bashar al-Assad's regime. And he was the one who told them that the focus of this Khorasan group was on external operations. So that doesn't sound like the most reliable intelligence, but what do you make of it?
No, with these organizations, their main focus is to perform unconventional warfare. That is the major tactic that they have to use, is unconventional warfare. And the thrust of Al-Qaeda's attacks over the last decade have always have been directed against external enemies and the FAR enemy. And that was actually part of the internal debate and dispute between Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and Ayman al-Zawahiri, was that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi was chosen to establish an actual Islamic government inside of an area that was part of the original core caliphate, whereas Ayman al-Zawahiri was in the mountains, he was on the run. Al-Qaeda had focused on grand attacks against Western targets, the FAR enemy, as we've discussed, and that what part of the argument that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi had with dispute in Ayman al-Zawahiri's leadership was a lack of focus on attacking the near enemy and actually establishing the Islamic State. So in terms of the doctrinal perspectives, the two organizations, it isn't that far of a leap to say that the Khorasan group would be primarily concerned with external operations, because that had been Al-Qaeda's modus operandi in terms of attacking the FAR enemy, whereas in ISIS had, for the most part, viewed its role as creating an actual caliphate modeled after that which had been established by the Prophet Muhammad and his successors inside the Middle East.
So, Nicholas Harris, in terms of their financing, are they independently financed, Khorasan, from, say, al-Nusra and al-Qaeda and ISIL or the Islamic State? My understanding is Mohsen al-Fadli, the Kuwaiti leader, does have a lot of rich contacts inside of Kuwait. But how does the money flow with these organizations? Do they do their own fundraising, or do they have a top-down distribution model?
Well, due to many different efforts, whether global counter-terrorist financing campaigns or local security forces clamping down on operations, these groups have had to turn to a multiplicity of sources. Whether those sources come from war, in the case of Jabhat al-Nusra, from donations by wealthy benefactors or benefactors, most famously in the Gulf through various Islamic charities, or whether from war booty that was seized on the ground, sometimes transnational crime and connections to transnational crime fuel funding. In the case of the Taliban, which had various times had ties to Al-Qaeda, you had the drug trade, which had been a source of finance. And so there's different ways for these groups to receive finance. And then at this stage, there doesn't seem to be any clear indicators of how the Khorasan group in and of itself was financed. But if it was embedded with Jabhat al-Nusra for a long period of time, then it would have had access to the various streams of funding that Jabhat al-Nusra received, which would come from various Islamic charities, from wealthy, primarily Gulf Arab benefactors, from the Kuwaiti stream that you had mentioned, from Mohsen al-Fadli, and from war booty that had been seized on the ground in Syria. that had also included at one point, before Jabhat al-Nusra had been removed from eastern Syria, or primarily, predominantly removed from eastern Syria by ISIS, the oil wells that are in eastern Syria in Deir al-Zor governorate that had been sold at below market rates under the table via Turkey and other countries in the region.
And that, of course, is something that presumably now that the Turkish diplomatic hostages have been released, Turkey now has no excuses but to face up to, you know, it hasn't joined the anti-Islamic State coalition, has it?
No, it hasn't. And actually, there's a really robust debate right now within the Turkish press. This is something that's very interesting to follow in light of the anti-ISIS coalition. And the main thrust of the argument at this point in time within Turkey, within the Turkish press, against joining, at least outwardly, against overtly joining the anti-ISIS coalition, is that ISIS is now Turkey's southern neighbor, and that because the United States had been unsuccessful in demonstrating in Afghanistan and in Pakistan and in Iraq and in Somalia, its ability to suppress the growth and particularly the building of strong local social ties of these extremist militant Salafist groups, that would not necessarily be in Turkey's interest to act hastily and to do more than just, you know, protecting its own borders, working with European countries, the United States, to interdict jihadists as they were coming from the West to try to enter via Turkey into Syria. Other than that, that sort of counterterrorism, internal policing role, the narrative is there's no reason to get involved in a foreign adventure against a political, social, military movement that could be Turkey's southern neighbor for a long time to come. And I also think that's probably expressed in that sort of view within the Turkish press is a sense of wonder if this Arab coalition can actually hold, and some sense of cynicism as to whether it will actually have an expeditionary capability to uproot ISIS from Mosul areas in Iraq, such as Mosul, and to uproot ISIS in areas of Syria. And there's a lot of questions moving forward whether a strictly air-based military campaign can actually remove ISIS from the ground in Syria and from the ground in Iraq. And if it can't, what then? Because then, to many people's analysis, the most capable military in that region would be Turkey, which is a member state of NATO, which has an advanced, modern, large army. And if the Turks aren't willing, in a hypothetical future, to intervene on the ground, and an air campaign hasn't been successful against ISIS, then there are going to be a lot of questions that will need to be answered about whether this air campaign was actually successful, and whether it would have been better to have tied it with some sort of limited military intervention on the ground from the start.
Well, just in closing, Nicholas Harris, you mentioned earlier that this new group that was targeted by 50 cruise missiles on Monday night by the U.S., Khorasan, which is supposedly a sort of hybrid organization that's with these al-Qaeda veterans who are recruiting all of these foreign jihadis in Syria. They've also reports that they've also brought some of their best bomb makers over from Yemen, etc. So is there, you mentioned at the beginning that this is kind of like al-Qaeda's special forces operation. Is that, just elaborate on that.
At what we know about the Khorasan group is that it is a multinational, multi-ethnic jihadist cadre that is drawn from experienced fighters that have fought in many different contexts under the al-Qaeda banner, and that its primary goal is to carry off attacks that would signal to al-Qaeda's enemies that while al-Qaeda may not have a clearly defined or state-like structure in place like ISIS does now, that it can still project power, and that though it may be perceived as being weak in a conventional military sense, it can still strike fear, and it can still hit its enemies hard when needed in an unconventional way.
And do you know anything about how many casualties they suffered in the Monday night's cruise missile attacks on their camps?
There are conflicting reports at this time. Some reports indicate that Muhsin al-Fadli had been killed. Others say that most of the Khorasan group leadership survived. At this stage in the game, this point in time, it's unclear the amount of casualties that have been suffered by the group.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Nicholas Harris.
Thank you for having me today.
Again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Harris, who's a Middle East researcher at the Center for a New American Security. He has extensive field experience in all regions of Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, and his work on the Levant, Iraq, Iran, and the Gulf countries is featured in many publications. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into whether or not Assad has reached the tipping point where he has to go. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Henri Barkey, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the U.S. State Department policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and has authored, co-authored, and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and Iraq, Its Neighbors, and the United States. He has an article at The American Interest, Is Syria on the Verge of a Tipping Point?, and another at Foreign Policy, How the Islamic State Took Turkey Hostage. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henri Barkey.
Thank you.
And the president is not meeting with the Turkish leader Erdogan at the UN, but perhaps they may meet on the sidelines. But Turkey's very much the odd man out in this situation. And you would think that all the neighbors, and here we have the president of the United States celebrating the fact that we're not going it alone because five Gulf Arab countries joined in with airstrikes. But it's pretty conspicuous that the biggest player with apparently a lot of skin in the game right there, Turkey, with major NATO base at Incirlik, is being coy, shall we say. And they've got their hostages back, so I don't know why they're not weighing in.
Well, there are a couple of reasons. I mean, I think they have gotten some of their hostages back. Yes, the 49 diplomatic personnel and their families who were in Mosul 100 odd days ago. But there's a contingent of Turkish forces in northern Syria in a little hamlet that is Turkish territory. And that hamlet is essentially, I think, surrounded by the Islamic State. So the Turks are not completely gone scotch-free with the end of the hostage crisis. So they have that concern. The other problem the Turks face is that the jihadist network, I mean, it's not just the Islamic State, but Jabhat al-Nusra and all the other jihadist organizations have created an infrastructure in Turkey that helps them, supports them, smuggles people and materiel across the border. And they have actually become a significant force in Turkey. I mean, you have a lot of jihadists coming in, landing in Istanbul, and somehow they make their way across the border in Syria. So on the way, they get housed, they get fed, they get sheltered in safe houses. So there is this network that can very easily turn against Turkey, and that's one thing they're concerned about. Now, the other issue is we do not know what kind of deal was made with the Islamic State when the Turks got the hostages back. I find it very hard that the Islamic State, which kept the hostages until now, would release them without some kind of quid pro quo. And just just at the time when the pressure on Turkey was reaching a maximum. So maybe the Turks, as the head of the Islamic State said, maybe the Turks did promise they're not going to get involved. President Erdogan today hinted that Turkish position on helping the United States militarily may change, but I still don't see the Turks participating in airstrikes. Whether or not they give access to the big base in Incirlik, as you mentioned, is another matter. It would be helpful if the United States had access to Incirlik. It makes it easier to strike. It makes it easier for airplanes to hover over the target area. When you fly all the way from Doha or from the Gulf, carriers on the Gulf, you have to be refueled on the way. You have to, and the amount of time you spend on target is limited, whereas Incirlik is much, much, much closer. So yes, it would be helpful, but it is not vital. I mean, let's put it this way. We can, you know, as United States did yesterday with its coalition supporters, it did manage to strike. So Incirlik is not vital. It will be helpful. And the Turks may actually help the United States in other ways. I mean, there's a great deal of cooperation on the intelligence level. Maybe that's where the cooperation will come. But I think what the United States would want from the Turks, most importantly, is to dismantle that jihadist infrastructure I mentioned earlier that is supporting ISIS, that is funneling funds to ISIS, that is helping with the smuggling of oil, etc. That needs to be dismantled, and that's actually difficult. It's not an easy thing to do.
But Henri Baki, my understanding is that the Turkish press is full of stories now speculating that perhaps Turkey shouldn't get involved in further in the war in Syria, because
should not, because the
argument being that the Americans have screwed up the neighborhood so much, starting with the original Gulf War under George Bush and Dick Cheney, which of course remember the Turks objected to that and wouldn't allow the U.S. to move material across its territory. And what I'm hearing from the Turkish press is, you know, that we may have to live with these guys next door to us, so because America screwed up so much, and they don't have a lot of faith in the cohesion of the America's Arab allies at the moment.
Well, look, I mean, the Turks definitely have a point about this current crisis being an offshoot of the Iraq War, but not completely. Let's face it, it's not complete, because what happened in Syria is it was a reaction to the Arab Spring. People in Syria got inspired by the Arab Spring. I mean, the Turks may blame the United States for not intervening sooner in the Syrian crisis, but neither did the Turks. I mean, you know, this is a crisis that was that started in Syria 3 years ago next to Turkey, and the Turks essentially helped make this crisis worse by allowing all kinds of jihadists go through that territory, and they supported some of these jihadists like Jabhat al-Nusra. So, I mean, I think there's enough blame to go around for everybody, and I think to play the blame game at the moment is not productive. That said, I mean, a lot of people have doubts about the United States maintaining a policy over a long period of time and not messing, if you want, this current policy. But look, the Turks, I don't think, have a choice in the long run in that they should not want ISIS as a neighbor. Nobody wants ISIS as a neighbor. And if ISIS becomes and consolidates itself as a neighbor, the people who are going to pay the price for it are not the United States, maybe a little bit, but it's going to be Turkey. Because ISIS is a jihadist organization that does not necessarily respect the fact that you have a quasi-Islamist government in Turkey. That's completely immaterial. I mean, these guys are purists. And eventually, this is going to start affecting Turkey, and we will probably see it manifested in terms of violence and maybe terrorist attacks, etc. And also, this infrastructure I mentioned that is created in Turkey, the reason I emphasize that is because that infrastructure is made up of Turks, of Turkish citizens. The other thing is that there are now an estimated 1,000 Turkish citizens fighting with ISIS. Now, some people say it's 600, and the rest may be, you know, cooks and, I don't know, gardeners maybe for ISIS. But this is a very, very large number, and some of them will ultimately come back to Turkey. And even if they, you know, these kinds of conditions under which you fight tends to upset the way you think about things, your rationality, and God knows what these guys will do. So the Turks are in this no matter what. They don't have really the luxury of saying, oh, we'll sit this one out and let the Americans clean it up. This is not, in fact, it's not an American problem. I mean, it's primarily a regional problem, and the region should have dealt with this a long time ago. Iraq is an American problem, not Syria.
Again, I'm speaking with Henri Barkey, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the U.S. State Department policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East and the Eastern Mediterranean and intelligence, and has co-authored and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and Iraq and Its Neighbors. He has an article at The American Interest, Is Syria on the Verge of a Tipping Point?, and another at Foreign Policy, How the Islamic State Took Turkey Hostage. Let's talk about your other article then, Is Syria on the Verge of a Tipping Point? And of course, that was written before airstrikes on Syria by the U.S. and 5 Gulf Arab countries. But I must say that the idea that you wonder what the Syrian people think of their leader, the one that's brought them this catastrophe, as you mentioned, inspired by the Arab Spring and then sparked by the fall of Gaddafi. And ever since then, he's all but destroyed the country, and because of his obdurance and arrogance, and now he looks completely irrelevant. I mean, he's got American and Gulf Arab planes flying over his country, cruise missiles flying over the Alawite areas, as though he's irrelevant.
Well, I think the problem is actually deeper than that. What I was postulating, what I was arguing, is that the Syrians have been fighting an insurgency now for 3 years, right? And now this insurgency has metamorphosed into the Islamic State. And the Islamic State is particularly vicious. And this is not about Americans, unfortunately, being journalists being killed, but look at what the Islamic State did to Syrian soldiers it captured at the Raqqa air base. It marched them half-naked into the desert, hundreds of them, and then executed them on the spot. Now, imagine you are a mother or a father whose son is about to be conscripted into the Syrian army. Now is a moment, and you see this catastrophe. You see what is happening to soldiers who get captured. You're going to ask yourself, am I going to sacrifice my son for Bashar Assad? See, until recently, Bashar Assad managed to convince everybody that in Syria that this was a fight for the survival, especially of the Alawites and the Christians. But now people must be asking themselves, is it really that? I mean, why is it that we cannot make a deal with maybe the moderate opposition, maybe with the outside powers? I mean, ISIS is now a much bigger threat to Syria than ever before. So in that sense, people are starting to question, and the New York Times actually had a great story, well-sourced story, about some of the discussions that are happening within the community, in the Alawite community, the people who are supporting Assad. And now the choice is between Assad and calamity, and it's not necessarily clear that Assad is going to save them, because the kids are dying. It's not Assad's kids who are dying. It is their kids who are dying in this war. And also, and another important fact, look, a large segment of the Syrian population is now outside Syria or is displaced. The bulk of the population that is the core of support for Assad is getting smaller and smaller. So the burden on that smaller community to supply men to fight is increasing, right? So casualty figures are being felt much more seriously among this smaller group, right? And that is engendering feelings. They don't know what to do. But it is, and I think where President Obama came up short, I think, is that he should have in all the speeches he gave on what to do with ISIS, etc., he should have appealed to the Syrians who are supporting Assad and say, look, we are ready to work with you against ISIS, but we cannot do it as long as Bashar Assad is in power. We're not going to do it when Bashar Assad is there. You get rid of him, then we can do business. And then you have to ask yourself, I mean, if you are part of that group, would you rather make a deal with the United States against ISIS and against Bashar, or would you stick to Bashar and fight for another 2, 3, 4, 5 years? I mean, in which case, your kids will be going to war. Your kids will be getting killed. Your kids will be getting wounded. So I think people get tired of war after a while. At the beginning, everybody is, yes, we're going to fight, we're going to fight. But they you know, much more sentimental about it. But once a war goes on for as long as it did, you know, people start recalculating their preferences.
Well, do you think just in the last minute that maybe the Russians and the Iranians are weighing in on him? And I mean, obviously, if Assad went, then the problem with ISIS could be solved much more effectively, couldn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Well, it's a dilemma for both the Russians and the Iranians, but for different reasons. For the Iranians, it's not so much the Assad regime that's important. It's Hezbollah in Lebanon that's important. Their fear is that if you lose Assad, then you lose the bridge to Lebanon. You lose the strategic depth that Hezbollah, the Shiite organization in Lebanon, has, because that is the most important tool the Iranians have in this chessboard, both in the region and internationally. So they worry that if Assad goes, Hezbollah is going to be in trouble, which is true. Hezbollah is already in trouble and will be in greater trouble if Assad goes. So that's that calculation. The Russian calculation is different. The Russian calculation is, we're not going to let the Americans win anything from now on. We are going to contest everything that the Americans do. And if the Americans want to get rid of Assad, therefore we're going to support Assad. But both of Iran and Russia have to think about the longer term, because the jihadist networks are inspiring other people to join the fight. There are a lot of people from the Caucasus, the Russian Caucasus, who are now fighting in Syria. The idea of the Sunnis taking on the Shia is something that will appeal to Sunnis who would like to take on the Iranians. I mean, it deepens the sectarian conflict. So both of these countries need to make certain calculations. And at the moment, they may still think Assad is worth the price. But a year from now, it may be a very, very bad bargain for them if you have a lot of jihadists coming back from Syria to fight in Russia.
Well, Henri Barkey, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Henri Barkey. He's professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East and Eastern European and intelligence, and has authored, co-authored, and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East and Iraq, Its Neighbors and the United States. He has an article at the American Interest, Is Syria on the Verge of a Tipping Point? And another at Foreign Policy, How the Islamic State Took Turkey Hostage. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into what took place on Tuesday's UN Climate Summit.
Sacred land, it has seen many hands, it has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old, and now the greedy souls just don't care to know of the changes it will confront. So speak out loud of the things you are proud, and if you love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds, cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Stavins, who's a professor and the director of the Environmental Economics Program at the Harvard Kennedy School and a lead author of three reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He has an article at the New York Times, Climate Realities. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Stavins.
Very good to be with you, Ian.
And on Tuesday, President Obama addressed the UN summit on climate change, titled Catalyzing Action, and he said that climate change is the one issue that will define the contours of this century more dramatically than any other. The alarm bells keep ringing, our citizens keep marching, we cannot pretend we don't hear them, we have to answer the call. Do you think there's a chance that all of these countries gathered will answer the call?
Well, I think there is a chance. It's not going to happen in New York this week. It does begin to happen. It's going to be in Paris in December 2015, which is an important stage of the international negotiations. The challenge is that although the president may well be right in terms of the importance of the issue, I don't doubt that, it's also true that given the global commons nature of the problem, it's not in the interest of any single country to really get out in front and take action, because each country can benefit from the actions of others. And because of the long-term nature of the problem, it's really asking citizens, voters, particularly obviously in democracies, to take on costs that are going to benefit future generations. And representative democracies, as much as we love them for lots of reasons, aren't terribly good at doing that.
Well, in terms of the president's comment, our citizens keep marching, there was an extraordinary manifestation in New York on the weekend of 320,000 people in the streets. And in London, there was about 50,000, in Melbourne, 20,000, and so on around the world. Yet I don't believe our press reflected those numbers or that interest. They were remarkably dismissive. Even watching CBS News last night, very little mention of this issue at all and what's happening at the UN. The idea that all these world leaders are gathering and that the UN has decided to have this conference, that in itself you think would at least elevate this subject to deserving more interest.
Well, it's receiving some interest. You and I are talking about it. Otherwise, you know, a week from now we might not be, and a week ago we weren't. So it's receiving more press interest, more attention from the general public than it would were it not for the Secretary General's climate summit in New York. But the climate summit was just meant to accelerate actions that are really taking place at the annual negotiations, December this year in Lima, and as I said, a year from now in Paris. That's where the real action is. Despite the fact of all the challenges that I think are real, the global commons nature of the problem, the long-term nature of the problem, actually I think that right now the likelihood of a meaningful international agreement is greater than it's been over the last 20 years.
But in terms of climate realities, which was the title of your recent article in the New York Times, you say the world is now on track to more than double current greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere by the end of the century. This would push up average global temperatures by 3 to 8 degrees Celsius and could mean the disappearance of glaciers, droughts in the mid to low latitudes, decreased crop productivity, increased sea levels and flooding, vanishing islands and coastal wetlands, greater storm frequency and intensity, the risk of species extinction, and a significant spread of infectious diseases. So that is a grim summary, which is probably an understatement given the gravity of the situation. How do you think we as a species could develop a kind of global patriotism, if you will, given that our planet is endangered and that we all share in that danger?
Well, I think the reality, Ian, is that to whatever degree that global patriotism would emerge, which I think of another way to characterize that would be sort of bottom-up demand from the population for actions by their governments, that's something that has happened in the past with other environmental problems, such as, you know, in the United States, our five major environmental statutes all are a result of observed or apparent disaster. But when the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland, Ohio, caught on fire something now like that's 40 years ago, the next day in the newspapers there were no articles that said, well, sometimes fires catch sometimes rivers catch on fire for natural reasons. It was obvious that it was a result of essentially pollution, contamination, oil residues. But it's not that way. And as a result of that, only within a year and a half, we got the Clean Water Act in the United States. That was from bottom-up demand. However, climate change is not like that, because I don't observe the climate. You don't observe the climate. The population in general does not observe the climate. We observe the weather. And the weather is highly variable. There is, therefore, you know, what you could think of as a signal-to-noise ratio problem, because we're seeing the weather, and even with the most abrupt kinds of climate changes, as we at the IPCC have been talking about, this rapid climate change, when one says rapid, the year-to-year change, the decadal change, is still much smaller than what we see week to week in terms of variations in weather. So I'm not very optimistic, therefore, that bottom-up demand will drive governments the way it actually has for quite a few other environmental threats and for other social problems.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Stavins, who's a professor and the director of the Environmental Economics Program at the Harvard Kennedy School and a lead author of three reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He has an article at the New York Times, Climate Realities. And the world's biggest emitter of CO2, China, didn't send their leader, and nor did India, who number three, and their emissions have increased just 5% in 1 year, this in 2013. The U.S. was starting to go down a bit, but it went back up again in 2013. But China's vice premier did say at the UN on Tuesday that his country is committed to cutting its carbon intensity by 40 to 45% by 2020. But you point out in the New York Times article, Robert Stavins, that China is expected to add the equivalent of a new 500 megawatt coal-fired electric plant every 10 days for the next decade. So that does seem like a step forward and a step backwards.
Well, I think it's true. So China is becoming, you could say, cleaner per unit of economic activity, but their rate of economic growth is so rapid that it overcomes whatever gains there are, and that's anticipated to continue for quite some time. I wouldn't make a tremendous amount out of the lack of attendance by the top people, the leadership, really, from China and India. And I say that for the following reason. In terms of India, remember the new prime minister, fairly new on the job, is coming to Washington, will be meeting one-on-one with President Obama, and I think it's just 2 weeks from now. Those kind of private bilateral discussions are, in my mind, much more likely to lead to progress on this very difficult issue, and a very difficult issue for India politically, domestically, to take on. In other words, it would be controversial for them to take climate action. That's where it's most likely to happen, is in those private bilaterals. Likewise, with China, something that I mentioned in that New York Times article is that something that's encouraging is the convergence of interest between China and the United States and the heightened degree of bilateral discussions between China and the U.S. Again, that's where I think we're most likely to see real progress taking place, as opposed to speeches that are given in the General Assembly today in New York City.
And you mentioned in your article and earlier in the conversation about the free rider problem, that economic self-interest of virtually no country, there's no economic self-interest of virtually any country to take unilateral action, and they basically would benefit from the actions of others. And at the UN, there was actually a rather angry speech from the Prime Minister of Antigua, who complained that a green climate fund, a pool of money created in 2009 to direct $100 billion to climate mitigation and adaptation work in poorer countries, simply hasn't materialized, and that the only country that's put any money up has been Germany. And again, Germany's an extraordinary case. They have the worst weather in the world, and yet they're going into wind and solar faster than and more thoroughly than any other country on the planet.
Well, that's true of Germany. They actually highly subsidized that action that they're taking, and also it becomes even more important now because their coal consumption, their coal burning is increasing as a result of phasing out, indeed phasing down completely, nuclear power within the country. The $100 billion fund is, I would say, very important in a geopolitical sense. And that is, if you were to ask me what is the one thing that could lead to the collapse of the climate negotiations and the failure for a meaningful agreement in Paris in 2015, I would say it's that $100 billion fund, because some of the nations, particularly, of course, the small island states, one can picture them walking out if something like that is not forthcoming. From the United States, this is very, very challenging, because if you look at both the phrase climate change and the phrase foreign aid, that's like two targets on someone's back in the U.S. Congress, particularly, obviously, from conservatives, particularly in the U.S. House of Representatives. So giving to foreign aid for the purpose of climate change adaptation and mitigation is going to be very, very difficult. The one way in which it would happen from the United States would be via the private sector, and that would be government policy, such as a cap-and-trade system or some such thing, that would actually leverage the private sector, which the Waxman-Markey bill would have done. I think it was $17 billion per year. It was predicted that that was going to leverage a private sector funding to developing countries for offsets, essentially. So that's a very big issue. The U.S. wants private sector funding, essentially foreign direct investment, to be included in the counting. I think it should be, but there are countries who are opposed to that and say it should all be public funds, that is, foreign aid.
So you mentioned, though, in your New York Times article, Climate Realities, Robert Stavins, that in effect Washington operates on the basis that they bribe voters today by borrowing money from our children and our grandchildren in the future, and that the challenge of climate change is to borrow money today from voters in order to take care of their children and grandchildren in the future. And that's simply not the way Washington does business.
Yes, that's true. I mean, someone who's vastly more politically astute than I am, a member of the U.S. Senate, who's actually a very big supporter, I'll leave him unnamed, but a very big supporter of climate policy action, has termed this as the most difficult problem politically that he has ever witnessed in many years in the U.S. Senate. And the reason is, one of the reasons is precisely that, namely that you're asking current voters to take on a burden in order to provide benefits to future generations. And it's not only future generations what makes it more difficult, it's future generations in other parts of the world, because the greatest damages of climate change are not going to be in the United States, and they're not going to be in the temperate climates. They're going to be in the tropical areas and low-lying areas. That's where the damages, at least from current analysis, are most likely to be greatest by far.
So you close your article in the New York Times by saying, talking about how we need to get away, Washington needs to get away from destructive politics and discover creative politics. And you say that destructive politics have been at the heart of the problem. The best hope may be that creative politics and leadership can help provide a solution. How do you literally reverse that trajectory, and particularly in terms of the deniers? I don't know what you can do about people who, I mean, obviously, it's a terrible portent what's going to happen to the planet and what's going to happen to us all. So I can understand, I guess that's why Al Gore talked about the inconvenient truth, that it is psychologically a lot easier just to sort of say, it's all made up and it's not going to happen. Anyway.
I think the reason why we find that perspective and that hostility to action to be so much stronger in the United States than we do in other countries, it's obviously vastly stronger here than it is anywhere in Europe, with the possible exception of some parts of Central and Eastern Europe. The reason it has to do with something that really does go beyond environmental policy, and that's political polarization in the U.S. Congress, particularly, of course, in the House of Representatives. Environmental legislation from the very beginning, from the first Earth Day in 1970, all of our environmental statutes were not debated on a partisan basis. It was not partisan politics, Republicans and Democrats, or liberals and conservatives. It was regional politics. It was different parts of the country. And it was the vast middle of what you could almost picture as a bell-shaped curve back then of ideology. It was moderate Republicans and some more conservative Democrats, this huge middle of the political spectrum, that's who supported environmental legislation for all these years. That began to change quite recently as the political parties began to move apart, mainly through movement of the Republican Party, but not exclusively that. And as you well know, the phrase moderate Republican is essentially nowadays an oxymoron, and conservative Democrats have disappeared. So each party has moved a little further from the middle. That's left no one in the middle. That political polarization has played out on climate policy. That's what makes it so terribly difficult. So to answer your question in terms of what could happen, I think what would is really going to need to happen in order to change the perspective politically in the United States is one of three things. One would be reversing that political polarization. And frankly, given the causes of it, I don't see that happening anytime soon. Another would be that there is a dramatic event globally that is obviously linked with climate change. And I don't mean increased storm frequency here or there. That doesn't do it because we can never definitively link it with climate change. But I'm talking about melting, severe melting of one of the polar ice caps, very dramatic sea level rise. Now, that's sort of too late. We don't want to wait till then, but that would have it, that would surely shift opinion here. And then the third is the one that you mentioned that I talked about in the New York Times article, and that's more creative politics. If I had the answer of what that creative politics looks like, I'd probably be running for office, but I'm not. But that's what we're looking for, and it's going to be creative politics from a younger generation, people vastly younger than myself.
Well, perhaps there's a chance that moderate Republicans can answer the call. After all, it was Richard Nixon who formed the Environmental Protection Agency. And I don't know whether you've been watching the Ken Burns series on the Roosevelts, but Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican, was the original steward of the environment. Republicans owned that brand.
Oh, absolutely. All of our major statutes that we have in the U.S. on environment were with Republicans in the White House. We took the lead out of gasoline, in fact, under the Ronald Reagan administration. The acid rain was cut by 50% on the Clean Air Act amendments under the George H.W. Bush administration. Even the George W. Bush administration, which comes much more recently, had major proposals on clean air, and including cutting sulfur dioxide emissions another 70%. And as you said, it was the Nixon administration who launched the Environmental Protection Agency, and that was the timing of the first Clean Air Act. The problem is those kinds of moderate Republicans, who sometimes were called country club Republicans or Rockefeller Republicans, and you could go back, obviously, to Teddy Roosevelt to see the beginnings of that, the conservationist movement. That part of the party has essentially disappeared, really, by being voted out of office, not in general elections, but by being challenged by more conservative Republicans in the primaries. That's where the heart of the decision-making is in the primaries as a result of redistricting and districts that are now 80% Republican or 80% Democratic. That's where the decision-making takes place. And in those primaries, it's only the most passionate voters of either party who even show up to vote. And so that causes this movement. It's one of the factors, not the only one, causing this movement of polarization.
Well, Robert Stavins, I really appreciate your time here today, and I thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Stavins, who's a professor and the director of the Environmental Economics Program at the Harvard Kennedy School and a lead author of three reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He has an article at the New York Times, Climate Realities. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.